North Korean drones breach South Korean airspace, the latest hostile act in a year that's seen Pyongyang test fire 90 missiles. What's the secretive nation trying to achieve? And how should Seoul and its Western allies respond without escalating into war? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. South Korea spends big on defence with a hostile neighbour across the border. So failure to shoot down the North Korean drones in its airspace on Monday has caused some alarm. The military has apologised and President Yoon Suk-yeol says the incident underlines a lack of readiness. We'll be discussing this and the wider tensions in the region with our guests shortly. But first, Eunice Kim reports from Seoul.
A brazen incursion by North Korea into South Korean airspace has left a sense of unease here in Seoul, so much so that the military has issued a rare apology for failing to shoot down any of the five enemy drones that flew in South Korean airspace on Monday. Four of those drones flew over Kangwa Island on the west coast, while the fifth flew past a border town, Paju, while flying in as close as the northern tip of Seoul, where the presidential office stands. Some concern that it may have gotten away with some of the pictures of the presidential office, so the military says it has no such data. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, in its apology, underlined that it is very difficult to detect and to target in civilian territory drones that are smaller than 3 meters in size, even as they promise to bolster what they can, including potentially running air defense drills at the Joint Chiefs level. The President, Yoon Suk-yeol, meanwhile, in his first comments at a cabinet level meeting this morning, recognized that military preparedness was simply not there, that training had lagged in the past years, as he called for the creation of a military drone unit, in fact, to bring it up as soon as possible, that would feature stealth capabilities as well as future technology. Eunice Kim for Inside Story.
Now, the drones are the latest military activity on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang has tested at least 90 cruise and ballistic missiles so far in 2022, more than in any other year, including the first launch over Japanese territory since 2017. The show of force has caused concern among its neighbors. Now, in response, South Korea held joint live fire drills with its ally, the US, extending the military exercises by several days. And Japan has increased its 2023 defense budget by 20% to a record $55 billion. That's a shift away from the pacifist policies in place since World War II. Let's bring in our guests. Mason Ritchie is an associate professor of international politics at Hankook University of Foreign Studies in Seoul. He joins us from Birmingham, Alabama. Joining us by Skype from London is Edward Howell. He's a lecturer in politics at New College, University of Oxford. And Lawrence Korb joins us via Skype from Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense. A warm welcome to you all. I'd like to begin with Mason Ritchie in Birmingham, Alabama. Mason, there's no other way of reading this other than North Korea tested South Korea's defensive capabilities and won. Is that right?
I think that's a fair argument, I think that this drone incursion by North Korea shows something that, frankly speaking, many people had already expected, that there were holes in South Korean air defense, particularly for these smaller drones, for instance. This has been a pretty big embarrassment for the Ministry of National Defense, for the South Korean military. It also exposes, I think, several years or perhaps even more than that of neglect on this type of, relatively asymmetric threat that North Korea represents for South Korea. It also falls into a line of errors and mistakes that we've seen the South Korean military make over this year, including a missile response that South Korea made that went wrong earlier this year, where one of its own missiles that was supposed to sort of counter the narrative of a North Korean missile test that ended up circling back and blowing up on South Korean territory near a populated area. So I think this is definitely a wake-up call to South Korea that it needs to up its game militarily if it wants to continue to deter North Korea from these kinds of provocations in the future.
Let's bring in Lawrence Korb here. South Korea is a key U.S. ally. The U.S. must be looking at this and going, where's all our money gone? Where's all our support for South Korea gone? With these small drones, they've managed to mount an incursion.
Well, there's no doubt about it. You got to remember that during the Trump administration, we downplayed our security relationship with South Korea. In fact, President Trump was talking about taking all of the American troops out of there. We finally started, you know, having exercises with them again. And I do think that that's one of the reasons why the North launched these attacks, is because they're concerned about the U.S. and South Korea working together and increasing their military capability. And don't forget, in addition to this, I mean, they've been conducting an awful lot of missile tests. I think it's something like 90 in this past year. So, and then finally, this had held for 5 years. And that certainly is a step in the right direction. But I think my colleague is correct. They're trying to show that South Korea is not that good. And they're probably also concerned that the Japanese are having a military buildup.
Edward Howe, what does this mean for North Korea? Is this a new, resurgent, confident North Korea that we're witnessing?
Yes, I think what's important to bear in mind is that even though this is not the first time in recent memory that we've seen North Korea use its drones, we saw North Korea do so in 2017, particularly in light of the deployment of the THAAD, the anti-missile defense system in Seoul. I think what this represents is Kim Jong-un and the Kim regime trying to fulfill what was basically a shopping list, a wish list of weaponry, of technology, of unconventional weapons that he outlined at the Eighth Party Congress last year. So we saw better warheads, new types of intercontinental ballistic missiles ranging up to 15,000 kilometers, solid propellant missiles, and also reconnaissance and combat drones. So the latter has arguably been ticked off. And yes, for all of the reasons that my two colleagues have mentioned, to show that the South Korean defense system is weak as a way of provoking the U.S.-South Korean alliance. But it's interesting to show how, although North Korea hasn't exactly responded to the most recent drone incursion, North Korea has responded to Japan's recent pledges to increase its defense spending to 2% of its GDP by 2027. So I think for North Korea, this is another step for the Kim regime, ultimately to desire the status of not only a nuclear state, but also a state with expanded scope and sophistication of a diverse range of capabilities.
We'll get into the Japanese thing in just a moment, but I want to bring Mason Ritchie in here. There is this idea of blowback, where the US makes a play and then that kind of backfires on them. President Donald Trump, Lawrence Korb just mentioned it here, was not quite a supporter of the Kim regime, but he was, you know, certainly talking to them. And then he's suddenly kind of out the picture now, but the North Koreans are resurgent and they see themselves as being able to mount attacks like this. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I would, despite the fact that I'm not in any way a Donald Trump fan, just to be on the record, I wouldn't say that he was anywhere near a fan of North Korea. But, you know, I do think that if anything, what this probably shows, you know, the last 5 years and arguably even going back farther, 10, 15, 20 years or even longer, is that no administration in Washington has a good answer for how to deal with North Korea. It's a really, really difficult problem. And frankly speaking, it's also hard for Seoul, obviously. In fact, arguably, it's even harder for Seoul. They have a much more complex relationship with North Korea, because the Korean Peninsula is divided, and obviously because North Korea is a much more immediate and direct threat to South Korea. So, no one has a good answer for North Korea, and North Korea, frankly speaking, exploits that. And so they exploit that sometimes through the use of strength, through testing ICBMs, through provocations, which we saw, for instance, in 2010 when they blew up a South Korean corvette and when they shelled islands to the west of Seoul and Incheon. So sometimes they engage in provocative military behavior, whether that be tests or whether that be kinetic actions. Sometimes they use what researchers have referred to as the tyranny of the weak in order to try to asymmetrically irritate or in some cases terrorize their adversaries. And these are extremely difficult and sometimes asymmetric provocations and asymmetric strategies that North Korea engages in that are difficult to respond to. So I don't necessarily, blame too much, Trump or Obama before him or Bush before him. No one's had a good answer for how to deal with North Korea. The same thing is true in Seoul. But the fact of the matter is the North Korean threat is growing. And, North Korea seems to be on the threshold of convincing the rest of the world in some sense that its possession of nuclear weapons is normalized, that it should be treated something like a mixture of Israel, Pakistan, and India. And the more that that is the case, the more that North Korea is going to have room for these kinds of incursions, drones crossing the border or the military demarcation line, mischief in the East Sea, mischief in the West Sea, and other types of actions that are unfortunately going to cause potential inadvertent escalation on the Korean Peninsula. And once that happens, all bets are off, because once you start an escalatory spiral, it's awfully hard to stop.
Lawrence Korb, what do you think of that? No one in D.C. has a good idea of on how to deal with North Korea. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think my colleague is absolutely correct. Because no matter how you handle it, it's going to be difficult. We don't want another Korean War, obviously. That we would like North Korea not to become a nuclear power, but we didn't want Pakistan to become a nuclear power either. And I think we're going to have to accept the fact that they're a nuclear power and deal with it in terms of the forces we have, the exercises that we conduct. And as also been mentioned, the Japanese are increasing their defense capabilities. So while North Korea certainly is getting, somewhat more powerful or closer to a nuclear weapon, their security is not increased if the United States and South Korea begin to increase their military cooperation. Japan does. And let's not forget, the North Koreans are also one of the two countries in the world providing arms to Russia here during this war in Ukraine.
Edward Howe, let's talk about containment here. If there's no real strategy to be able to deal with North Korea, the cost of doing business in that region means that we're just going to have to accept that North Korea will mount attacks like this. And as long as they don't escalate, that's the best we can hope for.
Yes, I mean, obviously, that is a very pessimistic scenario. But to reiterate what has been said and to develop on the points raised by my colleagues, are we getting to that sort of point? I mean, I just want to add, we've discussed different types of so-called mischief and provocations that North Korea has engaged in. I think we also need to add the cyber domain here as well. I mean, cyber warfare, as we've seen, particularly throughout this year, but also beforehand, has allowed North Korea to escalate, quote-unquote, tensions without really causing much change to the status quo. And by the status quo, I mean any particular form of response from the international community. You mentioned the idea of containment, and you mentioned the idea of whether, in fact, we are basically going to have to accept North Korea as a nuclear-armed state. Well, one of the concerns at the moment is that given the ongoing focus of the United Nations Security Council on Russia's continued war in Ukraine, actually, if North Korea were to conduct this seventh nuclear test that many analysts and researchers and policymakers have been calling and predicting for many months now, actually, this would represent a fundamental weakening of the United Nations Security Council, but also would North Korea get away with it more so than in previous years? Most likely, yes. So we're seeing North Korea take advantage, particularly now, of a weakened international order and a weakened sort of sclerotic United Nations Security Council focused on Ukraine, which North Korea can leverage to increase and accelerate its provocations, whether that's missile testing, whether that's drone warfare, whether that's cyber warfare or otherwise.
We have mentioned Japan. Let's get into that now. Mason Ritchie, the idea that Japan is now escalating quite massively its own arms program, perhaps in response to what North Korea is doing, but certainly as part of its own regional security, it must be worried about North Korea and China. Is there a danger of an arms race more significant than we've seen ever before?
I don't think that there's a danger of an arms race. There is an ongoing arms race. It's happening as we speak. Japan is going to raise its defense spending within the next 5 years, at least that's the plan, significantly. Whether or not they actually hit that 2% threshold, I think is perhaps a bit of an open question. But and more importantly, how that money is spent, I think, matters quite a bit. I mean, whether or not this goes into procuring new systems, and whether or not that's done with wisdom and intelligence, and how that fits in with Japan's larger evolving East Asian or Indo-Pacific defense strategy is, of course, a separate question. But it's happening. It's happening in Japan, which is developing or is going to be developing these counter-strike capabilities, which would obviously be able to hit North Korea as well as China. And in some sense, I think actually the Chinese threat from the perspective of Japan is really the more salient one than North Korea, although North Korea is clearly an important secondary worry. South Korea has been increasing its defense expenditures for at least the last 6 or 7 years, if I remember correctly, by every year anywhere between 5 and 8%. So South Korea is pouring money into its defense, into its national defense. You might ask where some of that money's been going, to the extent that they don't seem to be able to have an answer for these smaller asymmetric threats. But they are putting money into submarines. They're putting money into potentially a light aircraft carrier. They put money into F-35s, of course. They're putting money into unmanned systems. They're putting money into C4ISR, intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance capabilities. So South Korea is doing that. We obviously see China, massively increasing its military expenditures and growing its own nuclear arsenal going forward. So that's taking place. And North Korea is an instigator of this as well, as we've seen, with the development of the Hwasong-17 ICBM, which Professor Howell referenced earlier, it can range all of the continental United States with, a nuclear payload. How accurate that is and how reliable it is a separate question, but to some degree, we have to assume that it probably functions. So there is an arms race going on in the region. And I think one of the responses that we would like to see, perhaps, if you're Washington, D.C., would be increased trilateral cooperation between South Korea, the United States, and Japan, not only in terms of how it is that the alliance shares information with each other, or how the alliances share information with each other, but also particularly looking towards a combined or at least in part integrated missile defense posture. But that's something that's going to have to move extremely slowly because South Korea and Japan aren't on particularly good terms in a lot of ways. And so this type of defense cooperation is a relatively tricky endeavor domestically in both Tokyo and Seoul.
Well, let's bring in Lawrence Korb here. Lawrence, you mentioned it earlier, this idea that there is a very difficult way of dealing with North Korea that perhaps we don't have a grasp on. But is there anything immediate that the US can do now in dealing with North Korea? Is there a short-term, right-now solution?
Well, basically, I think make it clear to them that if they don't stop this behavior, we're going to encourage the South Koreans to respond. Don't forget, after this incursion here, the South Koreans did go into North Korea. And I think we need to make it clear that in a conventional war with South Korea, they would not do well. I think the North Koreans are also thinking that everybody's focused on Taiwan, so they can get away with this now. And of course, as you know, that if you look at the United States national security strategy, it's all about China and Taiwan. So, I mean, I can't get into Kim's head, but I do think he thinks we were distracted. And it's important that we convey to him, when the Japanese, if they go through with this, they'll be the third largest military budget in the world. And is this something that he wants, given the history between Japan and the Koreas?
Edward Hell, is there a way of bringing the North Koreans to the League of Nations, to use a very old-fashioned term?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that we need to understand that now is not a very good time for North Korea and that North Korea does not want to engage in any kind of dialogue, seemingly at the moment. And North Korea has always based its foreign policy based on this idea that its preferred outcomes will be met. And, you know, North Korea will only join any form of dialogue, negotiation, whatever, when it feels that it can get its desired outcomes. We saw this in Hanoi in 2019, the second summit between Kim Jong-un and Trump, which ended inconclusively because North Korea was not getting what it wanted from the United States, which at that point was on particular easing of very particular sanctions. Is there any way that North Korea can come back and join the negotiating table? At the moment, I think it's not in North Korea's interest to do so. At the moment, you know, as we speak, the end-of-year party plenum of the Workers' Party has just begun. We've seen Kim Jong-un discuss issues of crises happening in North Korea across this year. And usually what we've seen
Edward, we are running out of time. Oh, sorry, Edward, we are running out of time, and I do want to bring in Mason Ritchie here. Very quickly, Mason, the one country that we haven't really got into and talked about is China. Does China have a role to play in bringing North Korea to the table, or are they not interested either?
That's a very tricky, complicated question, and it probably depends to some degree on at what point you're asking it and what you mean when you talk about the role that China has. But the short answer to that is China could, if it wanted to, make life extremely difficult for the Kim regime to the point that it could very likely cause the regime to fall. And the way that it would do that would be to shut off oil supplies coming in through pipelines from China. However, it has no interest in seeing a failed state, especially a nuclear failed state. And it, of course, is nominally an ally of North Korea. They do have a mutual defense treaty. And thirdly, China has no interest, in the moment at least, in bringing its buffer state to heel. It's not particularly enthusiastic about North Korea having a functioning nuclear program and having nuclear weapons. And indeed, you know, from a North Korean perspective, I think in the back of North Korea's head, they probably look at those nuclear weapons as an insurance against Chinese meddling in North Korean affairs as much as they look at it, or at least in part with respect to how they look at it as a tool to be used against the U.S. And South Korea alliance. But at the end of the day, China has limited leverage because North Korea, you know, is an independent-minded state, does a lot of what it wants to do, and there is this sort of tyranny of the weak where China, you know, if it becomes too involved in trying to manage North Korean affairs, will see its own backfire effect. And if it goes too far, it might end up causing instability on the Korean Peninsula, which is what China wants absolutely to avoid. And so to that extent, it actually has relatively limited leverage.
I want to thank all our guests, Mason Ritchie, Edward Howell and Lawrence Corbin. I want to thank you as well for watching. Now, you can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.